From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
If the THAAD system were deployed on the peninsula, it would be focused solely on the DPRK and contribute to a layered missile defence that would enhance the alliance's existing missile defence capabilities against potential DPRK missile threats.
That was Yoo Jae-seung, Deputy National Defence Minister for South Korea, as he announced that Seoul and Washington have agreed to begin talks on the deployment of a THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. He was speaking at a press conference Sunday after North Korea launched a satellite into outer space. The U.S. insists that the defense system is to counter a growing threat from the North. China and Russia both argue that it would be aimed at them, would undermine regional stability, and could trigger an arms race in the region. China's foreign ministry called for calm and caution after the launch of the Earth observation satellite by North Korea Sunday, adding that the country, quote, is entitled to peaceful use of outer space, closed quote. However, China's foreign ministry did express regret over the launch, noting that Security Council resolutions currently restrict this right, and adding that long-lasting peace and stability can only be reached through dialogue. Sunday's launch of the satellite by North Korea was characterized as deeply deplorable by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who is himself a South Korean national. He said the launch Sunday was in violation of a Security Council resolution preventing North Korea from using ballistic missile technology. Daniel Dickinson has more.
The North Korean authorities reportedly said the rocket was fired to place a satellite in orbit, but concerns have been voiced that the real aim was to test a ballistic missile. The missile launch is in violation of a UN Security Council resolution. In January, the UN condemned a fourth nuclear test in Korea, a test which also violated international sanctions. The UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, called Sunday's launch deeply deplorable and urged North Korea to halt its provocative actions and return to compliance with its international obligations. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela holds the presidency of the Security Council this month. Its permanent representative to the UN, Ambassador Rafael Ramirez, spoke at a press encounter outside the Council's chambers on Sunday.
The members of the Security Council strongly condemn this launch. The members of the Security Council underscore that this launch, as well as any other DPRK launch that used ballistic missile technology, even if characterized as a satellite launch or a space launch vehicle, contributes to the DPRK's development of a nuclear weapon delivery system and is in a serious violation of the Security Council Resolution 1718-2006, 1874-2009, 2087-2013, and 2094-2013.
Sunday's emergency session of the Council was called by the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, and the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, also spoke with the press after the Council session, joined by the Permanent Representative of Japan, Ambassador Motohide Yoshikawa, and the Permanent Representative of South Korea, Ambassador Oh Jun. Japan's Ambassador opened the press conference.
My impression of today's meeting was there was a unity of the Security Council in the outrage of the missile launch which took place after 4 weeks of the nuclear test. I think this outrage is based on the fact that this is, whether you call it a satellite launch, this is the clear preparation for the missile, the long-range missile itself, and it is a clear violation of the past Security Council resolutions. There was, again, the unity on the members of the Security Council that in response to the DPRK, business as usual will no longer apply. There has been many resolutions which have not been implemented by the DPRK, and we have to work on this basis, working on the new Security Council resolution, which contains further significant measures, as we have already agreed. Just using a couple of minutes, I want to say on the view of the Japanese government that the seriousness of missile itself, this is the clearly direct threat to the security of Japan, along with the Republic of Korea, and also the country like the Philippines, whose so-called drop zone is in the vicinity. And we also know that this is the area where there is a very dense maritime and air transportation, which had also been disrupted. So we have to take this issue very seriously. It is not only the violation of Security Council resolution, but it is the real threat to the security of Japan, the Republic of Korea, and other countries, and including the United States. I think this is the one additional point that we have to emphasize concerning the missile test. Nuclear test is certainly more serious, and we wish that the Security Council would start adopting the robust Security Council resolutions, as we have reconfirmed our will and the determination today. Thank you very much. I now invite the Ambassador Samantha Power of the United States.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks for coming out on a Sunday. I just want to reinforce a couple of the points made by my Japanese colleague, which I'm sure will be echoed by the ambassador from the Republic of Korea. North Korea's launch yesterday using proscribed ballistic missile technology undermines regional stability and violates the DPRK's obligations under four separate Security Council resolutions, demonstrating yet again that the DPRK will continue to escalate tensions in the absence of a strong and forceful response from the international community. The accelerated development of North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile program poses a serious threat to international peace and security, to the peace and security not just of North Korea's neighbors, but the peace and security of the entire world. Pyongyang claims it launched what it called a peaceful Earth observation satellite, but nobody is fooled. So-called space launch vehicles are the same technology as ballistic missiles, which are expressly prohibited by multiple Security Council resolutions. Now, some of you may be hearing the terms provocative acts and provocations. These are almost euphemisms, I think, that have come to be used in the context of North Korea's advancing of its nuclear weapons program. But what North Korea is doing with each of these acts, these illegal acts, with each of these launches, is the launches themselves are advancing North Korea's capacity to advance its nuclear weapons program. They are not merely provocations. With each one of these actions, the DPRK moves one step closer to its declared goal of developing nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles, and we cannot and will not allow this to happen. We have been engaging in discussions with Security Council members on the appropriate response to the nuclear test that North Korea carried out now more than a month ago. These discussions are ongoing, and it is clear that the Security Council must take decisive action and to do so with urgency. President Obama spoke with President Xi on Friday, and in that call they agreed on the importance of a strong and united international response to North Korea's illegal actions, including through an impactful UN Security Council resolution. Each of these provocations Each of these illegal actions requires a robust response. Because of the DPRK's decisions and actions, we will ensure that the Security Council imposes serious consequences. DPRK's latest transgressions require our response to be even firmer. I want to make one thing abundantly clear. The goal of imposing sanctions has never been to target the North Korean people who have suffered unspeakable horrors inflicted by their own oppressive government. Horrors that the United States has repeatedly urged this council to address, and which the Republic of Korea and Japan, each serving their terms on the Security Council, have helped us bring to light in the Security Council, making a horrible situation for the people of North Korea a permanent item on the Security Council agenda. In other contexts, though, we have seen how robust sanctions can be a tool to alter a government's dangerous nuclear ambitions, how those sanctions can affect a cost-benefit calculus that a government acting in defiance of international norms may be making. So none of us here are for sanctions for sanctions' sake. We're for sanctions to make a difference and to affect the calculus of a regime that has brazenly and recklessly acted in defiance of international norms and in a continual threat to regional and international peace and security. We're looking forward to expeditiously consulting with our colleagues in the coming days, and we will be looking to all council members to unite around a swift and aggressive response to the DPRK's repeated violations that constitute this very direct threat to global peace and security. I thank you.
Well, with this launch and the nuclear bomb test last month, I think the DPRK is making a clear statement to the whole world that it is not only the only country developing nuclear weapons in the 21st century, but is determined to continue to defy the community of nations and to threaten the peace and security of the whole world. As pointed out by the President of the Security Council and by my two colleagues here, this is totally outrageous and unacceptable. As a Korean, it is sad, almost pathetic, to watch the staged celebrations on the streets of Pyongyang. As I know that the cost of this launch alone, estimated to be close to $1 billion, would have fed the entire North Korean population for a whole year. North Korea's recent provocations have clearly demonstrated two points. First, the efforts to achieve denuclearization through dialogue so far have only resulted in allowing North Korea to buy time to advance its nuclear capabilities. Second, given that North Korea continues to develop nuclear weapons under previous UN sanctions, it has become clear by now that the current level of sanctions cannot put a brake on North Korea's nuclear weapons development. Therefore, the lesson is clear. The only way to stop North Korea from going further down the nuclear path is to make it crystal clear to the regime that it has no option but to change. It is therefore an urgent task before the Security Council to adopt a significant and robust Security Council resolution that exceeds all North Korea's expectations and sends a firm message that the international community will never tolerate its nuclear weapons development.
The type of satellite that North Korea said it launched Sunday, an EO satellite, or Earth Observation Satellite, is actually a common one. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists and the UN Office for Outer Space Affairs, 192 EO satellites were in orbit at the end of January 2014, owned and operated by some 45 nations and or private organizations. Brian Becker is with the Answer Coalition. He also hosts a daily program on Radio Sputnik, Loud and Clear. He's visited North Korea a number of times, and we spoke with him via Skype Monday. The whole Security Council voted, all 15 members, to condemn the DPRK for launching this Earth observation satellite into orbit on Sunday. Many of them, it was because there's an actual set of resolutions from the Security Council that take away this right to launch satellites because of their concern over weapons of mass destruction programs. And China raised the question that, or raised the issue that, of course, North Korea has an inherent right to launch the satellites, like every other nation. And none of this is making the media here. Instead, the need to install more anti-missile missile defenses in this time in Korea, South Korea, is what's being reported here. Give me your take on what's going on.
The DPRK and the people in North Korea are extremely proud of another technological achievement. And obviously, it's a source of pride. And some of the Western media has recognized that that, in fact, is the case. The DPRK government realizes that there's nothing it can do right now that will make the Western countries that have demonized it so badly stop demonizing them. And what they are intent on doing is developing their technological prowess and their military machine so that they have greater leverage in international relations, especially when they have the United States government, which bombed the country to smithereens, destroyed everything between 1950 and 53. The main complaint of pilots at that time, U.S. pilots, was that there was nothing left to bomb because there wasn't a single structure higher than one story still standing. And 5 million Koreans died during the war. And the United States still has about 30,000 troops in South Korea. The United States is surrounding North Korea with the so-called Asian pivot, which puts by 2020 more than 60% of the U.S. military aircraft and naval vessels in the Asia-Pacific region, and of course targeting Korea in particular. The North Koreans have just determined a long time ago that they can't trust the United States. They use what happened to Libya in 2011 after Gaddafi gave up weapons of mass destruction, and Saddam Hussein, when they see what they see is actually true, that the United States realized that both countries could be toppled, the governments could be toppled because they were low-hanging fruit, meaning easily destroyed. North Korea is not going to be easily destroyed. China has a historic relationship with DPRK. I don't believe that China will, for 1 minute, sacrifice that relationship. There may be some within the Chinese Communist Party establishment that do want to do that, those who are oriented towards the West and some sort of rapprochement with the West. They do not have the upper hand in China right now. And I think the Chinese are saying, even if they're adhering to very formalistically UN resolutions that condemn the DPRK, because as you said, the DPRK doesn't, according to the UN Security Council, have the right to do what all other countries have the right to do, I mean, in practice. Even though they vote for the resolution, China has been saying the problem in the Korean Peninsula is complicated, there needs to be a resumption of negotiations, etc. The most important thing, Don, I think for our listeners, your listeners, to know is that 1 year ago, the North Koreans offered to suspend all future nuclear weapons tests, not necessarily rocket tests, but nuclear weapons tests, if the United States would cancel the war exercises that were planned for 1 year ago. The war exercises with South Korea, which are massive and simulate the destruction of North Korea, its invasion and decapitation. The North Koreans offered that. Now, nobody in the United States knows this because the United States media won't tell them. The North Koreans offered to do that, and the United States said no. The United States said, no, we're going to go ahead. Now, why was that necessary? Why was it critically necessary for the United States to go ahead with the simulated destruction of a sovereign government, a government that it had previously almost destroyed completely in 1950-53? Why was it? Was it imperial hubris? I don't think just that. I think the United States, in fact, doesn't want to have at this point, a sort of relaxation of tensions with North Korea. They still have in mind regime change, and they also want to continue to use DPRK not just as a punching bag, but as a pressure on China. I think what they're really hoping for is that by intensifying pressure on the DPRK, it puts pressure on China. They share a border. They are historic allies. And the United States is hoping that within China, there would be some sort of Gorbachevian, to coin a new phrase, grouping within the leadership that would say, hey, it's just not worth it. We'd rather have peace with the United States. Let's get rid of our relationship with the DPRK. The DPRK knows this, and the DPRK is not counting on China because they realize that after what happened in the Soviet Union, even their biggest allies could become unreliable should they be toppled or another grouping take over that was willing to opportunistically sacrifice its allies. And so the DPRK is just going ahead with building its technological and military prowess to make it clear that they're not really reliant on anyone, even though they'd like to have good relations, I think, with everyone.
And, you know, there's an odd symmetry here. You know, basically the characterization of the DPRK by the United States and the responses that that characterization enables, if you want to consider them responses, to what they did with Iran. Iran was characterized as an irresponsible player, despite the fact that it hadn't invaded anyone in several centuries, and that they were hell-bent on acquiring nuclear weapons. And this, in turn, enabled the United States to justify, or in any event was used to attempt to justify, the installation of anti-missile defense systems in Eastern Europe and Southwestern Europe and Asia. And the same thing is now being done in South Korea and Japan over this alleged threat from the North to start firing intercontinental ballistic missiles at the United States.
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. The U.S. is building rapidly missile defense systems. Missile defense systems are not missile defense systems. It's kind of a, you know, it's the language that's also confusing to lay people, lay public, people who aren't watching or paying very careful attention. The point of a missile defense is to take away from your enemy its ability to harm you, and to send retaliatory missiles. So, say for instance, if the United States carried out nuclear strikes against the DPRK, or a big conventional military strike, and the DPRK decided to hit back at the United States with its missiles, the missile defense shield would presumably catch those missiles or enough of them to take away the ability of the DPRK to retaliate. So a missile defense shield has to be recognized for what it is. It's part of a first strike offensive weaponry. In other words, the U.S. hits North Korea, takes out a big part of its military operation, and enough so that should the DPRK be able to fire off some level of rockets or missiles back, the defense shield would catch them. That relieves the initiating party, the offensive party, the first strike party, of the danger of sort of mutually assured destruction. So missile defense shields, they were banned. The anti-ballistic missile treaty between the United States and Soviet Union and later Russia was designed to stop the adventuristic first strike warriors from being able to go forward. In other words, it upset equilibrium and allowed one side to think that they could actually win a nuclear war.
Right. So, you had a condition since the 1940s, when the Soviet Union announced its first atomic test, of what they called at the time, and still call, I guess, mutually assured destruction, which actually forestalled, most likely, any nuclear war, because whatever party was thinking it was okay to start a nuclear war understood that it would finish on their own territory. And now, as we've seen from Foreign Minister Lavrov from Russia, with the nuclear deal with Iran, the excuse that was used by the United States to install that kind of a weapon system around Russia turned out to be not true, because those weapons have not been withdrawn. Now they're installing them near China and the eastern part of Russia.
Yeah, and the other thing is, all of this goes with a new generation of nuclear weapons, which are so-called smart nukes, that is, precision bombs that can be dropped in with greater specificity, greater particularity, greater targeting. They can either increase or decrease the yield. In other words, the United States has developed under Obama, and clearly in violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which creates an affirmative obligation on nuclear powers to not advance and continue to expand its nuclear arsenal, but work towards getting rid of them. That's the quid pro quo with the non-nuclear powers not acquiring nuclear weapons.
Right.
U.S. is violating that, increasing its capacity to actually develop nuclear weapons that are more usable. And the DPRK and all the other countries in the world realize this to be the case. And again, what should they do? Should they just sit there and wait? Should they sit there and wait and say, well, yeah, the Pentagon is violating the NPT, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, creating a huge new arsenal of nuclear weapons that will be mass-produced, spending billions and billions of dollars more right now, in an escalating modernization program. But the other countries that are potentially targeted countries should just sit on their hands. I mean, that's essentially what the U.S. media says, is if North Korea does nothing, we can still call them the rogue nation, the failed state, blah, 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 talk about them in the most hideous terms, and prepare the population to hate them and possibly accept going to war against them. And if the DPRK does anything like launch a satellite, use rocketry, have a nuclear weapons test, that's like a fundamental act of aggression, even though the United States, Russia, China, and many other nuclear powers do these things all the time. And as you said, 45 countries launch satellites. I mean, what DPRK just did is completely in conformity with the international law regulating the launch of satellites. It's just that the UN Security Council has passed this web of resolutions so that if DPRK exercises its rights guaranteed by international law, unlike all other nations, it's then targeted for more sanctions.
You know, finally, there's an interesting twist in the rhetoric out of Washington over this. The United States launched its first successful orbital satellite in 1958. And at the time, there were some people on the left in particular here who were saying that the space program in general and the satellite launches that were taking place in particular were really masking the development of ICBMs for war with the Soviet Union. And now that's exactly the charge that's being leveled at the DPRK, despite the fact that Washington denied it at the time and has denied it continuously since then.
Yeah, and I think that the DPRK, like the United States, recognizes that rocketry using ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missile rocketry, to launch satellites does have a dual use, just as the U.S. Pentagon recognized it to be the case in the 50s, that this does have a military function too. They're launching a satellite, which they have the right to, as do other countries. But yes, of course, there is a military capability. And if the DPRK perfects this kind of rocketry, it means that it has the potentiality of hitting targets many thousands of miles away, including the west coast of the United States. And that means that the DPRK is not intending to start a nuclear war with the United States. I think they know that that would mean their own obliteration, nor do they want that in any way. But it does mean that they're sort of evening the scales a little bit, and the United States would have to recognize that it's pretty dangerous to go straight at the DPRK, and that's what the DPRK is doing. They're developing a military capability because they want to defend themselves.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.